Welcome to another episode of In the Name of Service, a podcast committed to sharing the untold stories of those who selflessly serve. Each episode features an interview with men and women who have been called to a variety of service-focused roles, such as the military, law enforcement, ministry, volunteering, and more. You aren't likely to know the names of the individuals you meet here, but our hope is by the end of our time together, you'll not only know their stories, but possibly be inspired to write your own in some way. Humble in nature, but strong in character, these everyday men and women showcase what it is to truly be a servant. We're glad you're here. Now here's your host, Dr. Barb Thompson. All right. Thank you so much for joining us for another special episode of In the Name of Service. So this episode is going to be a departure from what the type of episode that I usually host. This episode has three guests, not just one. And it is because the topic is very special as well. So you may have or may have not listened to episode 30 with Michael Halterman. He recently lost a prior teammate to suicide, and that was his fourth teammate in 4 years. And so after we had spoken, he talked to me and he said, let's have a conversation and meet this enemy head on. And I said, yes. And then we decided to bring in a couple people to help us talk about that. Both talking about our personal experiences with suicidal ideation and our experience losing people we love to suicide. Unfortunately, Halty was not able to make this conversation. And so I have three fantastic people here with me, and I'll let them introduce themselves so you can hear their voice. We're going to have two females, two males on here. I'm going to let them introduce themselves so that you know and can kind of keep up with who's speaking, and then we'll get right into it. So we'll go with Brandon, Leslie, then Evan. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about who you are and why you're on the call?
My name is Brandon Wood. I served in the United States Air Force as a pararescueman for 15 years. Before that, I was a security forces guy. And now I serve as an associate pastor at Aberdeen First Baptist Church in Aberdeen, North Carolina.
Thanks, Brandon.
And I'm Leslie. I served in the Navy from 2008 to 2013 as a damage controlman. I did one Westpac deployment, 1 9-month deployment. And I have essentially been a veteran advocate since, I would say, 2017 after the loss of a good friend of mine. And that's who I am.
Thanks, Leslie.
My name is Evan Jones. I was a combat controller in the Air Force for 15 and a half years from 2004 till late 2019. Served fair number of tours overseas, got out, like I said, in 2019, and now I live in Boise, Idaho, and I sort of study creative writing and some other things.
Yeah. At the end of the episode, I do want people to know how to contact you guys. So if I forget, please remind me. I want them to know about Climb 4. I want them to know about, Evan, your website and all of the things that you're authoring, the pieces that you're authoring, so that people can read them and be encouraged by them. So this is not an easy topic to broach, but essentially what has transpired and led to this conversation, you heard about Halty losing a teammate that very same week. Leslie lost someone that she loves that very same week. Evan lost someone that he loves to suicide. And so we are here with kind of the military mindset, meeting this enemy head on. And what we want to describe for you as a listener is the types of feelings, the types of thoughts, the things that this specific enemy uses to get us to a point where we're having those thoughts of suicide. And then also what we feel like have been very effective weapons for fighting this particular enemy. So that's going to have us talking about our own personal experiences in kind of the depths of a valley, and also our experiences losing people that we love. So Evan, I'll have you start us off, if that's all right, and tell us about your personal experience.
Yeah, thank you. My personal experience is a big topic for me, because I lived through suicidal ideation from my first combat deployment in 2008 until more recently. Sometime within the last couple years, I was struggling with it. There was an ayahuasca ceremony that I went to in December of 20 that really helped move the needle. I mean, almost completely eliminated suicidal ideation from my life. But it took a few other things and another, couple of years. For today, I feel extremely safe. It's just, I don't want to say it's not a thought, but it's almost, it's just not there. Like, the pressure isn't there. Compared to back in where I was on a combat, mission. I was involved in the death of most of the family, like half of the family, to include an infant. And I dropped two 2,000-pound bombs on a house on a compound, and it ended up killing, most everybody in that compound, to include that infant. When we came up, just seeing that after everything that I had been to, everything that I had wanted to be in this world, everything that I wanted to bring as, a spirit fighting for what's right in this world, and then to be involved in that, and then for myself to think that I was completely responsible for the death of that infant, I wanted to kill myself. Like, I wanted to be dead in that moment, and I struggled with that. And similar experiences from until a lot more recently. So I've lived it for a while. So when I talk about this conversation, or when I'm having this conversation, there's just a lot that comes to mind, because I lived it for such a long time.
Yeah.
And so I have to zoom out quite a bit. And zooming out helps. And zooming out lets me see that there are a lot of factors involved. One of the things that just really comes to mind, though, as far as one of the most helpful things, and I can only see this in retrospect, and I'll try to describe it, the word that's coming to mind is basically humility. Is one of the most helpful things. And it was humility of people around me, and the universe, God, that saved my life. The opposite of that, there's a scripture that comes to mind. I can't remember the particular one. I think it might have been in Proverbs it's in Proverbs. I wish I could pull it up at some point, but it refers to contention only comes from pride. So much of the contention that I was feeling in my life was coming from, and I can only see this in retrospect as I zoom way out, just this collective pride within humanity and all the different wars that we've been fighting, everybody thinking that they're completely right and fighting each other, and just like this fighting comes from the pride that we all have. And the only thing, when I look back, that saved my life was the humility, the spirit of humility, whether it was from God or whether it was from a person. When I was met with people who were prideful, and when I was struggling, there were some people who they just didn't understand. And in their pride or their unawareness, they're like, what the fuck is your problem? I don't fully understand my problem, but I can tell you right now, I'm drowning.
And
it's this like spiritual, psychological, and even physical, physiological drowning. And I was thinking about this earlier today. If somebody's physically drowning and you see them,
right,
what's the best tactic for that? If you are an incredible swimmer and you have the right gear, you can go out to that person. Or if you're pararescuing with like a hoist, you can go down, you can hoist down, you can grab that person, you can save them, and you can bring them up. Or if you're on a raft, you can throw down a life raft. But it requires a certain amount of expertise and skill and humility for that and training for that pararescue man or whoever to save that individual who's drowning. We can just observe that. We can observe the humility that it takes to humbly train to do the hard things day after day after day, and then go into someone who might have gotten in a situation like, why is this person out, you know, sailing by themselves in the Baltic Sea or whatever, you know, and they're now drowning. We can criticize that person all we want, but or we can just save them,
right?
And I'm gonna start to get, I don't want to get too far down that rabbit hole, but I felt like the things that saved me were, I mean, it was those things that embodied that spirit of humility. Different people who came to me, hey, Evan, I've experienced this thing, ayahuasca, I think it could help. Hey, I experienced this cognitive processing therapy. I don't fully understand what's going on with you, but I think it could help. Let's walk through it. And it took not just humility, but I guess now that I think about it, that love, which, let's say, you know, if we're using the 1 Corinthians 13 definition of love, love is the act of this combination of all these different energies, but the act of humility, the act of meekness and temperance and patience and kindness. That's it. Maybe that's a better word to use. I think love gets overused sometimes, and we refer to a feeling. We refer to a feeling as love a lot. But when we look up the definition of love, it's more complicated than that. And it is a series of actions. And love saved my life. Anyway, so I'm speaking to a little bit of my experience. But yeah, as I'm kind of working through that combination of that love and humility is what saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
And when I speak with people who are struggling, because I still speak with a lot of people who are struggling, people feel safe to talk to me because I've been there. I've been that drowning person who was saved. And I just try to approach those situations with as much love as I can. Not like, oh, I need to feel this feeling of love for this person. But I approach it with kindness and patience, long-suffering, those kind of things. I do my best to approach it that way. A belief in what they're saying, believing in all things, and endurance, attempting to approach it with endurance and those different elements. So I'll get off my soapbox.
Yeah, and we're going to hear from Brandon and Leslie as well. But I do have one question for you, because you continued to deploy. I'm like 15, like a crazy number of deployments. Like, you were still operating at a really high level, but yet you were carrying this the whole time. You mentioned it feels like drowning. Like, how did you do that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It almost killed me. There was this, what comes to mind, it's interesting, I don't know if this, like, I don't know how accurate this is, but it's just coming to mind, is there was a certain level of unconsciousness that I was just operating in a certain level of unconsciousness, sort of like that head down, I am rocking in this direction, and going to rock in this direction until I am dead.
That's
what I was doing, and it's like, why are you walking that way with all that weight? And then I was like, I don't know, man, but this is the way that I am going.
Is,
why are you carrying all that weight? I don't know. What's in there? I don't know. That's a lot of stuff.
Right, yeah.
So I don't know. Looking back, whichever word you prefer to use, the God, the universe, the all that is, that, spirit gave me all of that, and I have that experience now, and I'm incredibly grateful for it, because I can hopefully help people heal. I can help people take things out of their rock. I can help them find a new direction if they want to go a new direction. I can speak about the tools that saved my life.
Right. Yep.
And hopefully, save other people's lives, and ideally make the world a slightly more peaceful place by the time it's time for me to go.
Yeah. You know, when you're drowning, you're just all you can think about is your next breath. So it is like right now you're thinking, oh, you know, to think about this experience, I really have to back up. You know, I have to get like the bird's eye view and then I can kind of conceptualize these different things. But when you're just trying to survive, that isn't the way that you're thinking. And so it took someone outside of you to, it took something in someone, you know, outside of you to say, like, here's what's going on. Like, just walk over this way and take this off, right? So I think that is one strategy, just that, like, or one tactic of this particular enemy is that they get you alone. They make you, it makes you feel hopeless, like it's never going to change. It makes you feel helpless, like there's nothing that you could change, even if there was something to change, and that it's always going to be this way.
Sometimes it really does feel like a it for me, it just felt like a assault, and I didn't it, like a full on it's pretty nuts. And then there were only things that I was speaking to a friend about this the other day. There was a time, this, you know, it was maybe 2.5 years ago or something. I was sitting on my toilet with my gun in my head, trying to calm down enough to pull the trigger. And I was sitting there, but my cell phone was on the floor. And I'm just extremely drunk and just trying to get drunk enough and calm enough to do it. And then this text popped up and it said, "What you doing?" Like all one word. And it was my neighbor. And I'm sitting there with a gun in my head. And then, like, that's it. Like, that text saved my life. And that was the only thing. Like, I was right there. And, you know, I didn't ask her to send that text like that. I was like, by the grace of God, just this text came in and pulled me out of it. And then I'm like trying to answer this question, like, what do I say to that? I'm sitting on my toilet with a gun in my head. And it was nuts, but it saved my life. So that one text, that one person just reaching out, not in any kind of crazy way, but just with a "what you doing" text. So when I look at how I'm attempting to move through life now and those
These
experiences
different
that
types.
I've had in the past, I tried to do that more. I'm still bad on doing it. Like, there are teachers that I've met now,
If you can imagine.
they make that a part of their daily practice. They reach out to someone they haven't reached out to in a long time every day. They do that. They incorporate that in their life. And more of us are starting to hear about those tactics. And those are the kinds of things that are going to start saving more people's lives. It's not, you know, I've vented about people doing push-ups on website that, you know, can help to a certain level. But at the same time, I don't know, when I saw that, and I can only speak from my experience, it was infuriating. Like, when I was seeing people do that, I was like, man, I just want to talk to someone. I want to watch people do push-ups. Like, I want to connect. I want to talk to someone.
Thank you for saying that, because and sharing that. Because I think for some of us, this feels so big that we can't do anything about it, but we can all be used. You know, when someone pops into your mind, I can easily say, because of Evan, I'm not going to ignore that, you know, and I'm going to send the what you up to or what you doing text. So, yeah.
There's one other quick thing that comes in mind is the so I'm currently working down at assessment selection for pararescue and combat control, and the guys who are familiar with that training, they know about things like 10-ups and water confidence and everything like that, and the pool. So anyone who's familiar with pool work and combat dive and all that kind of stuff, you know, it pushes you to your limit. And some guys experience shallow water blackout. They will, in that environment, push themselves as far as they possibly can until they're unconscious. And like, if somebody outside of them doesn't grab them and pull them out of the pool and save them, they'll die. So they will do that thing that I was doing. I was just like, we train in these types of, well, in the military, like, it's ingrained in us to train. Like, you will exert everything that you have until you die. Not everybody does that. Some people do that. And then my friend Bo, who just killed himself, he was trying to leverage every resource he had. And then, you know, there was a point at which it was for him.
Yeah.
He exhausted everything. And when I look at it, like, I could have reached out more. That's just the fact. I could have done more. And it brings me to this place now where I have to be honest with myself about that and do my best and pray to be better about it, to send those texts, those what you doing texts, to touch base with, to see what I can, little percentages here and there in my life where I can, you know, where I can do something for someone outside of myself.
Evan, I appreciate you sharing your story. And I especially as you talked about the drowning, the weight of all of it. What came to my mind, Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, where Jesus says to come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden. And if you look at that word heavy laden, what it really means is the idea of a ship that is overweighted with goods and is sinking. And that's what Jesus tells us to do. He says, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden. And then he makes a promise. He says, I will give you rest. I will give you rest. So, I appreciate you you talking through the scriptural references and things that have helped you. And ultimately, I believe that the enemy in Ephesians chapter 6, it tells us that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but of powers and principalities. So there is a true sense of evil and darkness in the world. And those are the things that we're battling against. Barb, especially just talking about having a military mindset against this, in that same passage of scripture, it talks to us about putting on the whole armor of God, right? So being prepared for that battle. The only way we can ultimately be prepared for that battle is if we have come to the end of ourselves. I love the fact, Evan, you said humility and how important that is, both the humility of others and ourselves as well. But where we come to the end of ourselves and we recognize we can't do this on our own, right? And then we go to the one who can help us, right? We go to Jesus, we go to him and we believe in him and we repent of our sins and we believe upon him. And then we do have a sense of joy after that, like the Apostle Paul, right? The Apostle Paul, he ends up shipwrecked in prison. And ultimately we know he went and was martyred. That's what history tells us. He was martyred on the side of the road and just left there. But ultimately, we know that even through all of his hardships and struggles, that he had a joy that surpassed all understanding. And that was a joy that was only a joy that a person can have if they have come to Christ in faith with a heart of repentance. And now they're indwelled by the power of the Holy Spirit. So I think it's really important, like you say, I think it's important to tackle this head on and what it is. And ultimately, if we trace it back to its original root, to sin, we live in a fallen, broken world. And I'm not saying that, those are the ultimate things that end up being the definitive points in people's lives, but they are the things that allow us, if we will be cognizant, humble ourselves, to get to a place of brokenness where we recognize we have greater need. So I think that's an important thing to think through.
Yeah, thanks, brother. Thanks for sharing that.
Leslie, do you want to tell us about some of your own experiences in your valleys and just some of the things that you've learned, especially being so close to losing people that you love?
Yeah, so I guess before I get into that, I kind of want to go a little deeper into how this all kind of manifested for me with building a nonprofit that outfits veterans with backpacking gear. It all kind of stemmed from somewhere. And it's funny how, you know, when you look at nonprofits, right, like almost every nonprofit that has been created from a point of extreme pain.
Right? Yes.
Like, whether it's Mothers Against Drunk Driving, whether it's, you know, Find a Cure, you know, cancer research nonprofits. Like, there's, you can always trace it back to a point of absolute extreme pain.
Yes. And
I guess that's where it started with me, right? It was, you know, I served in 2008 to 2013. Then the deployment that I went on was 2009, 2010. In support of the counter-piracy operations that were going on off the coast of Somalia. So it was considered a combat deployment, even though we were on a ship. Without getting too deep into the hardships that kind of went untreated, I learned very quickly the evil that lingers in the corners of this world, both from the enemies that we are facing and that we're at war with, and
right.
And our own people. So both things kind of happened for me, right? It was not just the person on the other side of the battlefield. It was the people next to me that I had to really pay attention to on that deployment. So from that deployment, I still had about 3 years left, two and a half years left. And the things that had happened while on that deployment kind of culminated into me needing to be removed from the ship and seeing a therapist and being put in a, you know, it's called transient personnel unit, which is, I mean, there's a whole slew of people that are in that command. It's like you either popped for drugs, or you're just processing out, or you're on your way to a different command, but they're deployed, so you can't get to them. It's like just this like real melting pot of people. And so did that. I was stationed in Hawaii for that deployment, guided missile cruiser, after I got out of A school, and it was a newly integrated ship, which means that it was an all-male ship before I got there. And so when I got there, I very quickly realized that I was the first female in the engineering department, and I was third overall on a ship of 400. So that, in combination with, I was raised Roman Catholic. I went to an all-girl Catholic high school. I joined right after high school. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, what this meant. You know, I had a high school sweetheart who treated me very well. Like, I thought that if you were nice to me, that meant you were nice to me. And I didn't know that it meant really anything else. So going on, I transferred to a ship in San Diego, and that ship ended up being, you know, night and day difference from the ship that I had, had left. And still then, you know, even when I was going through therapy at the transient personnel unit, I would like to go back to what you guys were saying. It was all pride, right? I'm fine. get out of like, stop with the notebook. Like, I'm good. And it's true. That's how I approach therapy. And so I was like, just get me out to another ship. So I got to this command, night and day difference. It was beautiful way to end my service. But then I get out in 2013 and didn't apply for disability. There was, you know, I got out, I had already signed up to go to school, went to school in San Diego. And then that's kind of when self-medicating started kind of taking its form. And it started with alcohol. And then, you know, when the alcohol kind of prohibited me from alcoholing, I used other uppers, and I got really, really in the weeds. And basically that went on from middle of 2013. I got out in August. It started almost immediately after that until a DUI in 2016, just maybe a week after my birthday. And I'm sitting in a jail cell, and up until this point, I had been hanging out with the wrong crowd, but essentially it felt like the right crowd. I was having a lot of fun. And then here I am, I'm in this jail cell, and I am thinking about my life, and I'm thinking about, like, how did I get here? Obviously I know how I got here. I drank and drove, but like, how did I really get here? Because I have parents who are high school sweethearts. They've been together since they were 16. They love each other. I have two beautiful brothers who took care of me. Like, where did it all go wrong? And I kind of put the pieces together on my own. I had quite a bit of time to think about that. So my parents bail me out of jail. And it was kind of like a switch was flipped. And I was like, I have to change how I'm approaching this. Obviously, I'm not okay. Like, people who are okay don't get in a car drunk and drive on a highway. Like, they just don't. So it's not fun anymore. I get out, I lose my job because I didn't show up to work. And I was scared and I didn't know how to pay rent and nobody was hiring at that time. And even if they were hiring, it was the only job that I had in that industry where I couldn't put them as a reference, right? So a lot of things came crashing down at once. And I did have a particular hobby. I did love running half marathons and marathons. I loved trail running. And that at that point was the extent of like my outdoor nature therapy experience. Was I really just loved to go on the boardwalk and run, loved running in Coronado, I just loved to run. I would put my shoes on and I would go for as long as I could. And so I was doing a little bit of research while I was unemployed, and it just kind of led me to the PCT. So the PCT was a trail that started in southern San Diego, right at the border, and it kind of spanned about 2,600 miles up the West Coast. And I kind of did the math in my head. I was like, well, if I sell all of my things in my apartment and pay off my credit card debt from the debt that I've been racking up from not having a job and paying off this DUI, you know, maybe I can do that. Maybe what I need is just to get away from the people that are around me and focus my attention inwardly. And so that's what I did. I sold all of my belongings. I had one dog at the time. I had gotten somebody to watch him for the entire time that I was going to be gone. He's a great dog. So I'm starting to plan and I'm starting to realize how expensive gear is going to be. I don't have a tent. I don't have a sleeping bag. I don't have anything that I need to do this hike. And I start to realize, I'm like, this stuff is really expensive. How am I going to do this? And I decide to post on Facebook and I tell everybody what I'm going to do. And just shockingly, everything that I needed was donated to me. And I would like to say that all of it was from veterans, even from veterans that I didn't know, veterans in active duty. I mean, within a couple of weeks, I had everything that I needed aside from food. And so very, very helpful. So I'm driving to Kentucky from California. And there was a girl named Candace who was very, very close to me on my second ship, the Good Ship. We're very, very good friends. And she's in on all of this. She knows what's going on. She's checking in on me. And she lives in Arizona at the time with her fiance and her son. And as I'm driving to Kentucky, I realize that she's kind of on the way. And I said, hey, Candace, like I texted her and I was like, I'm driving through, like I'm passing Phoenix, but I'm literally in your area. Like, where are you? And she was like, oh, we live in Prescott. Like, that's a little bit further away than Phoenix now. Why don't you just stop where you are and I'll meet you somewhere. You can just stop at a coffee shop or something. And I was like, oh, well, how about I come back when I come back? Like, I'm kind of on a time crunch. How about when I come back on the way back after the food's done and, you know, I'm waiting for my permit date to start, I can come back and hang out with you, Benji and Matt for a little bit. She was like, yeah, Matt and Benji would really like that. And I'll never forget that text. It's exactly what it said. So I said, okay. So I go, I'm dehydrating food. I'm with my parents and I'm having a good time. And it's late at night one night and Matt texts me and he's like, are you awake? It's like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, well, I am now. And he said, are you in a place where you're going to be okay? And I said, what is going on? And the text message was, Candace shot herself and she's dead. And there's nothing that you can do for somebody who's received that information. It was like I was so immersed in my own issues and my own problems and what I was going to do to get out of my own stuff, that if I were in the right frame of mind, I could have read those micro hints, right? But I wasn't there. I was hurting. And that's something that I've had to kind of cope with and learn through, that we are all going through our own struggles. It can be very hard. It can be almost crystal clear on the other side, right? Well, I could have reached out more. I could have done this. We are all struggling. This life is baseline struggle. That's all it is. So, so I find that out. And, in so many ways, I decided to dedicate this trail to her. I print out silicone bracelets, like 500 of them. And I have this idea that I'm going to pass them out on the trail to everyone I meet and have them use the hashtag and take a picture with the bracelet. And I was going to collect all of this stuff to give to Benji. Fast forward through that trail, I decided to start a nonprofit, and that was to basically pay it forward what had happened to me. I know that the gear is expensive. If there was a veteran that felt or had an inkling that backpacking could help them in any way, the way that it helped me, I wanted to be a part of that. So I started Climb 4 after I got off the trail in 2017, started the business plan, and it just took off from there. We've outfitted over 80 at this point. And it's always been a passion project. And where this ties into Michelle's death is I got very comfortable. Michelle was one of my dearest friends, and I knew she was struggling. She was very open about it. But I felt as though, first of all, Michelle, her brother committed suicide. So not only does she know that pain, she knows what it's like to get the phone call, but she also knows me. And all of my social media at this point is talking about Candace or talking about Clem 4 or talking about talking to people. And so I think that I have this like force field over my camp. Over my camp, right? Anybody that is directly in some degree affiliated by me or who know me, they have all of this information at their fingertips. I'm posting about, you know, different nonprofits that are in the area. I'm always involved in the coalitions that are going on in Virginia Beach where I live. And so I felt like there was this just like protective barrier, and that I somehow had this like some night vision goggles on, to be able to see what people couldn't. And I have to come back to what you said, Evan, cause I was getting a little uncomfortable and I know it's just me. But sometimes it is not just to reach out. I was in contact with Michelle until the day she died. And I was begging her to let me see her. She lived in Arizona. What's crazy about both of these things is that both of these girls lived in Arizona and they both died in January. So it's, I begged her. The last text that I ever sent her was, she had lost her job in December, right before Christmas. And we were planning a ski trip for January. And I said, okay, like what's going on with the ski trip, you know? And she said, I can't, I just lost my job. And I know that feeling. I know what that looks like and feels like. And so we started that conversation, you know, and I was extremely attentive to her. And the last text that I sent in so many words were like, I wish I could just sit next to you. There's nothing that I can say to make you feel better about this. But I just wish I could sit with you in it. And I am flight away. You just tell me when to come. And then I found out on Instagram that she had passed away. So a very big, legging company, posted it, very shortly after she had died. And there just wasn't enough information out about it. So I had received the information that it was posted. It wasn't even given to me by our close friends or anything. Like I found out on a post. And what I have come to realize, I've done a lot of research on this. Like I'm trying to understand all of this, and it brings me back to the hike to the PCT, right? So one of the biggest things that I learned was sometimes we just don't have the ability to see past the mood, right? Like things can feel so big and so overwhelming, and like we just need a little bit of time. And I watched this documentary once it was about the Golden Gate Bridge and how that is the deadliest bridge for suicide. And there was a gentleman on there that had survived his jump. I jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and he survived. And one of the things that he said that I'll never forget is that the second that he jumped, he regretted it. Like the second his feet left the bridge, he was like, what have I done? Michelle had also died by gunshot. And that's not something you can really come back from. It's pretty finite. And it's so important to understand that. And I really did start to understand it on the PCT. I remember, you know, we're going through the Sierra Nevada mountain range. We're going from 9,000 feet back down to 8, back up to 13, down to 9. And if you weren't freezing in the valleys and getting eaten up by mosquitoes, you're getting windburn and sunburn up at 13. There was no comfort. And it was a 3-mile stretch. And I remember so many times I would just lay in my tent and I'd be like, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. But there was no getting out of it. You know, I either had to walk forward or walk backward, but I couldn't just say I quit in the middle of it. And that's the unique thing about suicide is that you can. In those moments where you are so, so, so low that you cannot see the other side. I mean, right when I got out of the Sierras, all I wanted to do was keep going, you know, but it took 300 miles of saying, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. And not having a choice to understand that there are good days on the other side of it. Mm. You have to have that information. You have to have that experience, that data to say, you know, I have waited before in moments of hardship, moments of struggle. And I have seen proof that there is good on the other side of this. And I think that is the most important thing. I'm a Christian. I believe in God, but I do believe that it's kind of like the pyramid of foods, right? You've got your meats, you've got your breads, dairy, fruits, vegetables. I believe that faith should be kind of consumed in the same way. Like you must have a great support system. You must devote yourself to service. That's something that I've really, really feel that has helped me get out of my own funk is by pouring myself into others. And then really, really great activities that you enjoy, passions that you love, that are outside of your job that you just can pour yourself into, whether that be art or music or backpacking or fly fishing. Those are all extremely important. So that was probably very long-winded. I have no idea how long I was talking.
It doesn't matter.
So that's where I'm at. It's, I'm very sensitive to it. I just got back, from her service and it was very difficult. And so I'm just still kind of crunching through it, but those are the things that I've learned is that it tends to be this like, obviously, there's a gnawing pain that you deal with, like a baseline struggle that you deal with. But in those moments when you're saying, I'm going to do that, it happens in an instant.
Right.
Like in that moment, like you said, Eben, when you're on the toilet, like and you've got the ammo and you've got it, you've got the idea, like in those tiny seconds, like that's where the decision is made. Fully. And it's hard to tackle that beast. It's hard. I just posted about it. It's very difficult to win the race against those thoughts to your friend. So it's definitely a unique topic to cover because we have so much, that we need to learn still.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah. I haven't told anyone about this, especially not my professional life. In fact, when I was getting ready to leave school, trying to get like my pre-doctoral internship before I got my PhD, you know, they have you interview with all these people. I ended up, of course, joining the Army, as most people know. And I wanted to write about my own experience with suicidal ideation and was encouraged not to. Like, no, that's too much. Like, you know, people don't, they probably, if you want to help people, other people probably don't want to think of you as like being so broken, but I just think we're broken out of the box, you know? And so hope is always there. We don't ever have to feel like we are whole by ourselves, because we aren't. We're broken right out of the box. And my experience, I was 19, and for me, it was over. I had experienced just like pain, lots of struggle with broken relationships and really tough, you know, financial circumstances. And, you know, pain now that I look back on and I think like, it was painful, but I have more and more perspective as I get older. In the moment, I knew the Lord, but I was not focused on the truth. What I was focused on were the thoughts that I was believing about myself. So the specific attacks were like, you're worthless, you have no value, there's nothing special about you, right? Like you could go on living, but you're not here for a specific purpose. And whatever you think that purpose is, it doesn't really matter. It's not that important. You don't really have a lot of control over where your life is going, so you might as well just give up. And by the way, you probably don't want to tell anyone what you're feeling, because then they might think a certain way about you. So for me, it was that I felt worthless and I was isolated. I didn't want to tell anyone about it because it felt like embarrassing, but that was the old lie. That was the lie that I was believing, right? That wasn't the truth. The truth was, like, I had family and friends that loved me dearly, that would have stayed with me, talked with me until the end of days. And I actually went, but it happened when I was isolated. And I think that is a specific tactic of this specific enemy, is that it will isolate you, wait till you are alone and feel like you cannot contact anyone, and make you feel shame for wanting to, or guilt, whatever it may be. And that's just a tactic. That's not the truth. That is a tactic. That's a strategy, right? So I went to the movies. It was like on a spring break, my freshman year of college. I went to the movies that night with one of my best friends, and I knew like that night, you know what I mean? It was over for me. And I could not, and I'm struggling with this the whole time. I could not, she's right there. She's right next to me. Like, I can reach out and touch her. And I knew she loved me, and I couldn't do it, right? Because I was believing lies. And in any case, what it felt like to me was an experience I had never had before. I was on the ground, basically just like crumpled, you know? I felt like I was literally being attacked, even though I was alone. I would, you know, just on the ground thinking, I don't want to do this anymore. And then I did have the thought, like, just wait till tomorrow morning. So that was a Saturday night. I was like, okay, I'll give it one more day. And I went to church the next morning. And then a lady with the same name as me, which is just weird, but she looked me in the eyes that morning and she said, you're not okay, are you? And I still couldn't say it out loud. I knew I wasn't okay, you know, and I had already missed a chance the night before. And I just shook my head no. And she, and that's what you, like, Leslie, you're talking about, like, just do it. Go overboard. You know what I mean? She said, you're meeting me right back here. It's fine. We can eat lunch, but we're meeting right back here. And I've never been the same, because I learned that, yes, I could believe in hope, but I wasn't feeding myself. Like, you're talking about the food. Like, it matters, right? And I wasn't eating. So of course I was going to shrivel up and die. Of course. Anyway, not many know that. And as a psychologist, it's probably a little taboo to put it out there that you've been there before, that you thought about taking your own life, like it wasn't going to be worth it. But, you know, now it's 20 years later, and I look back on, you know, Leslie, you had asked me a question when we had been on the phone previously, like, all these great things you're doing, these people you're impacting, like, could it have happened without the pains? And I just said, no. Like, your story is so beautiful. And my story couldn't have happened without me getting to that point either, you know, because I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of this enemy. I'm not afraid to call it out. I'm not afraid to talk about it. And I'm not afraid to prepare people with the weapons that I feel like equip them to fight it, whether they're alone, even though I don't encourage that. or with other people, which I do encourage. Brandon, I know you have, you're just in a position where people come to you. And a lot of times they come to you when they are, they're done.
Yeah.
Would you mind talking about, I mean, you've got experience losing your brother, but you're also now in this position where you're combating, you're helping people combat this specific enemy, you know, on a daily basis.
Right. Yeah, I'll start just by telling a little of my story, because I think that's important to the context. And also exactly what you said, I think that our greatest impact in this world comes from our greatest points of brokenness. So these are the days that I lost my brother. That was one of the hardest days of my life. But on September 7th, of 2007, I was at Medina Annex, in Texas, in San Antonio, Texas. And I was there doing a pre-dive course. I had been out of the pipeline for a bit. So they were taking guys who had been out for a while post indoc and putting us back through a process just to ensure that we were still physically prepared to go to dive school. And this was shortly after my wife had been diagnosed with cancer. And I'd left dive school at one point to go home to be with her as she had a surgery and follow-up treatment and that kind of thing. So I'd been out of the program for an extended period. But I was at Medina Annex. It was a Friday. And we had just finished our training day that day. And I'll never forget, went back to the room. As I got into my room, my priority was to get a shower and to get, you know, to get ready so that I could go out and eat and hang out with the guys. And I'll never forget, my phone rang. I looked at my phone. It was my brother. I remember looking at the phone and saying, you know, I don't have time right now. I'll call him back as soon as I get out of the shower. And I threw the phone on the bed. So then I go get cleaned up. And by the time I got back to my phone, I had missed, I don't know, 12 phone calls or something like that. And phone rang again, and it was my wife. And she told me the hardest news you could ever hear, that my youngest brother, Trenton Wood, who was his best friend, talked to him every time I got into my truck. It was just that he had taken his life, self-inflicted gunshot wound, and very bad situation. You know, he had kind of had a life that was kind of a spiral. He was in the Coast Guard. He ended up getting kicked out of the Coast Guard, substance abuse and different things like that. So he ended up getting dishonorably discharged from the Coast Guard, came home, was having relationship issues, had a young son, and just, I don't know, it culminated on a night where there was a lot of drinking involved. There was just a lot going on between my youngest brother and my middle brother. And man, my middle brother's a true miracle story, but so my youngest brother ends up at my middle brother's home, and there was a little bit of an altercation between those two. And my younger brother went to his car and got his weapon and came and took his life, you know, right in front of my brother, my middle brother. But yeah, just like I said, receiving that phone call on September 7th was, it was devastating. I mean, it was, you know, Leslie, you said it's like one of those moments where it's like there's really nothing in that moment that you can, you're just grasping, trying to think through things and just kind of in a haze. I was fortunate that day. You know, I had some great guys there with me. There was one of the pararescue instructors, Aaron Butler, strong believer in Christ. He was there. He responded to me in a very loving way. For pararescuemen, he was there. He responded as well. And Ben White was a pararescuemen who actually lost his life on Pedro 6-6. But both of those men were there with me, and were able to help me get plane tickets and get to the airport and do all the things I needed to do to get home. But so that was a very broken point. And then it wasn't many years later that my dad actually passed away. And he died from, I mean, he was heartbroken over the loss of my brother, and a lot of other things. And he also was a substance abuser and ended up taking too many sleeping pills one night. So anyway, a lot of tragedy. And that's why I say I truly believe that God, he utilizes people who have truly been broken. Steve Lawson, a pastor that I love, he says that to use a man greatly, God has to break a man greatly. So I believe that in our brokenness and in this heartache and these trials, that these are the greatest tools that we have to be able to help others. And Barb, like you said, there may be a stigma, but you're able to talk to people in a manner that other people can't because you understand, because you've been there. I just think that's so important. That it's actually one of the reasons why I was called there, you know, that I recognized the call to ministry. One night I was reading a book for my undergraduate degree, and I was reading a chapter, and it was titled, and, you know, as I was reading this chapter and I was reading it, I was just like, God, I don't want to do this. I don't want to go into pastoral ministry, you know, these kind of things. I have other plans, but if I can do this, if I can just be able to share my experience and also share how faith in Christ, it radically changed my life. And can help other people, then I'm willing to do this, you know, the rest of my life. So it was a definitive part of the process in me recognizing that I was called to ministry. And then, like you said, Barb, now just because of access, I mean, I'm still in Aberdeen, which is really is where we work, Evan. You know, and there's so many guys who are going through so many things. Just broken dudes. I mean, and by God's grace, our church has partnered with the unit. And there's the psych staff, the human performance folks, they use room here often to do marriage counseling. So it gives me a great opportunity to be able to talk to guys. And it's just like over and over and over, people are experiencing very similar things. And mm-hmm. I think that's important. Barb, you said that mm-hmm. I think that the disposition, the beginning disposition has brokenness. And it mm-hmm. is because of we live in a fallen, broken world, right? We live in a fallen, broken world. So that's the baseline. It is the disposition. And we are broken people that need this hole filled in our hearts. Blaise Pascal said it, I think, the best. He said that all of us have a God-shaped vacuum in our heart, and that we struggle and we try to fill it with all these other things, but it's never truly filled until we fill it with God through Jesus Christ. Now, we talked about this the other day. That does not mean that a Christian is immune, you know, from suicide. It doesn't mean that in any way, shape, or form, because, you know, it's just, again, we live in a broken, broken, broken world. And sometimes people do. You just get to the point where you feel like there's no other way. But I'm so thankful that, like, God has rescued us. And we've been able to experience these hardships. And now I just pray that each one of us will be diligent to utilize the pain that we've been given as an opportunity to help others. To rescue others, Evan, like you said earlier, to be there to rescue others, and to point them to hope and to to show them where real joy comes from. And I do believe, I believe true and lasting joy comes from Christ. So, and I think that's important for us to contemplate.
Thanks, Brent.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's something comes to mind. Could I share? Unless you had something
Please. Yeah, please.
It's funny because that what's coming to mind is this conversation that was, and I don't know if Brandon remembers this, but this conversation that we were having in a van or at some, in a van down by the river. You know, and this, all the way up to, we're going to Virginia, or DC, or we're going to the beach or something. And, you know, for those of you who haven't met Brandon out there, he's just, you know, and I'm not flattering him right in. He's just a really good dude. He's just
thank you, brother.
Really humble dude and one of my favorite people that I've ever met. I tend to just love everybody now, so don't let your head too big there, Brandon. But you know, you're talking about the stuff like you're talking about. This was back in maybe 2000 or something, and you're talking about Jesus Christ, and I was like trying to get it, and I was like, dude, I don't get it. I just could not understand what you're talking about. And I remember listening, and I listened to a lot of my friends. There's a number of names that come to mind, and I was an atheist. So I don't remember if I don't know if you remember that, but I was an aggressive atheist. And like now I've been humbled in a number of like very interesting ways. But I kind of want to speak to that because I think what you're saying, like there's a lot of truth to that. But for me, there were a lot of, I remember hearing similar things and there were just a lot of barriers for me between like the word that comes to mind is like, there were barriers between me and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Like what you were talking about. And those took a few steps to sort of overcome. One of those, and I'll just mention this because it's coming to mind, it was super awful for me, but I was watching this YouTube video once, and this guy, he said, he's talking about all this weird stuff. I was going through my divorce, and I was watching it because he was going through a rough divorce, and I was doing research on my divorce and trying to find out what I could do. But towards the end of this video, I watched a number of his name's Cal Washington, and he said, I encourage you, if you have an opinion of the Bible, I would encourage you to ask yourself where that came from. Did it come from reading the Bible or did it come from somewhere else? That question changed my life because every opinion I had of the Bible came from somewhere else. It came from somebody talking about it. It came from the Catholic Church. It came from mainstream Christianity. It came from everywhere other than actually reading the book. So when he said that, I cracked open the book, I went to Proverbs, and it immediately got weird. So I just encourage people who are struggling with things out there, you know, when we talk about humility and stuff like that, like just entertain a slight amount of humility, crack it open, and just like look, and like cracking it open and reading some of it changed my life in ways I just could not have conceived of. And I started learning things. It's just nuts. And when you hear people talk about it, it sounds nuts. It's like, right. No, that's nonsensical.
Right. Sounds like foolishness.
Totally does. And it's like, yes, it does sound like nonsense. Also, like, go... just check it out. Yeah, just like read it. If you're struggling with the idea of all of this weird stuff, 100%. I totally get it. And also, like, if you're curious about it, check it out. Like,
yeah, I think you're right. And I just want to say this about just that, like what you said with the scriptures changing your life. I have seen it over and over and over. So there's peace in that book. It's so full of peace, so full of hope. And ultimately, the overall message of the scriptures is that we're a broken people, just like what we've been saying already. and that God provided a way of salvation for us in Christ.
This is an ongoing conversation, but what I do hope is that through our own experiences, like already the listener, you know, four people who have been there, you're not alone. The thought that you are alone is a lie. The thought that you don't have any community that you belong to is a lie. Those are strategies, right, of this enemy. The thought that you are helpless to do anything that will get you freedom, peace, joy, love, that is a lie. The thought that your life is worthless, that it has no purpose, that is a lie. And that is a strategy of this specific enemy. And for us, you've already heard us talk about the weapons that we've chosen to take up, you know, for our own struggles and our own battles. And it always involved other people, right? Like the use of other people. So you're combating that isolation and loneliness with community. And it's not a thought that you want. It's not what you want to do in the moment. It's just that if you recognize the enemy, then that's the weapon that you take up. We've talked about, you know, getting out in nature, like being reflective and prayerful. And we've talked about specific scriptures to feed our souls the truth that combat the lies of this particular enemy. So again, there's no great summation. I'm not going to do it justice. I'm just so thankful that like we've been able to have the conversation, honestly. And tell people where they can find you if they feel like, you know what, like what Brain was saying makes sense, what Leslie was saying, like I just need to hear from her. I need to talk to her. Or I want to hear from Evan. What's the best way to reach out to you guys?
So you can reach me at brandon.wood12@gmail.com. That'd be the best way. And then if somebody has a need to meet or to talk or whatever, we can set that up.
Okay. Thank you, Brandon.
You can find me on LinkedIn at Leslie Irby. You can find me at leslie@climb-4.org. You can find me on the Climb 4 Instagram at climb4_. Those are going to be the three main ways to get in touch with me. And I welcome all to any conversation.
Yes. Thank you.
And you can find me, the best way would just be to go to evanpjones.com. So EVAN and then P for Patrick, JONES.com. And then I have links to all of my social media stuff there. So LinkedIn, Instagram, YouTube, all that kind of stuff. And I've got a couple stories on there, which you can check out. You can also send me messages through the website or through my LinkedIn or Instagram or any of that. So check those out for sure. This is something I find myself incredibly passionate about. I sincerely appreciate this conversation and thank you for setting this up.
Absolutely.
And Leslie, I like how you mentioned just the fact that like, the solution to this problem, that's not just one thing. It's not just sending a text. It's not, there's no simple answer. It's very, very multifaceted. And I think that's something that's important to remember too. Serious problem. There are a lot of things I think about, like MetTC and Okoka and stuff.
Yes,
like mission analysis. If we're looking at this, if we have a mission, we're doing the analysis and then we're looking at the enemy and looking at key terrain and all of the different factors involved. And yeah, in this fight against what seems to be this, that the terrain is vast. There's a lot that goes into this. But there are a lot of us here willing to help, ready to combat this enemy and figure out what's going on.
Thank you guys for your courage.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another incredible episode of In the Name of Service. If you enjoyed today's episode, please like and subscribe. And of course, feel free to share with those you feel would like to be inspired. Have a difference maker in your life that you'd like to see featured? Reach out to Dr. Barb Thompson at inthenameofservice@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.